What's it all for?
Various artists.
Studies for a Keepsake is a new exhibition at Gus Fisher Gallery, tracing the lives and work of pioneering French artists Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore. The exhibition is the first time these artists have been shown in Aotearoa. Working in writing, photography, collage, performance and sculpture, and associated with the surrealist movement in the 20th century, Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore were visionary artists, activists, collaborators and lifelong partners. As gender non-conforming artists, they defied the social norms of the time. For Cahun and Moore, their art was a form of resistance against the context they were living in, defined by warfare, uncertainty, exile, genocide, and fascist political agendas, and the social norms that followed. Their work was virtually forgotten until its rediscovery in the 1990s, paralleling the rise of postmodern feminism as part of this expansion of understanding of identity politics, acknowledging gender as performative rather than fixed, and refusing essentialist feminism. Showing their work in Aotearoa today, Cahun and Moore's legacy lives on through their powerful art making and stories of resistance that continue to resonate with viewers a century later. I had a kōrero with curator Lisa Beauchamp about the exhibition and the lives and work of Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore.
Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore were French artists working during the 1920s, really, in Paris. They were originally associated with the French surrealist movement, but they weren't born in Paris. They were both born in a more rural area called Nantes. And Cahun, in particular, was born into a literary family. So their uncle was, a prominent writer. Their father ran a kind of big local newspaper. So they actually kind of, I suppose, their kind of first entry point into kind of cultural activities was through writing.
Mm.
And similarly with Marcel Moore as well. So Claude Cahun was born Lucy Schwab in 1894, and Marcel Moore was born Suzanne Malherbe a couple of years before. And they holidayed together, their kind of family kind of became connected. They holidayed in Jersey kind of every year. And then, they became very close friends and then lovers and then artistic collaborators. So, kind of initially kind of writing was their kind of first kind of foray into creative kind of activities. And then they began kind of experimenting with photography, collage. They moved to Paris and they contributed writing to various kind of literary journals, became associated with different kind of creatives there. And then it kind of blossomed from that point, really.
I guess what I think is quite interesting about both of them is they never exhibited their images or their practices really during their own lifetimes, which I guess was a big factor in how they remained virtually forgotten until the rediscovery of their work in the 1990s. Are you able to speak a little more to this lack of recognition during their lifetime and later rediscovery, the factors that contributed to that and how and why perceptions of them and their work shifted in later decades?
I mean, really, we kind of need to remember the context they were working in. So, in Paris, kind of post-World War One, the kind of creative community anyway, very progressive in terms of, kind of thinking thoughts around kind of surrealism and the unconscious and kind of really pushing the boundaries of the mind, very kind of, Claude in particular was involved with kind of avant-garde theatre as well. Marcel, working a lot with illustration and writing. In 1930, they produced a publication called Avu Non Avenu, sometimes translated as kind of cancelled confessions. So it's kind of largely known. So Cahun kind of did all the writing for that and Marcel did the collages. And a lot of those collages, the kind of the portrait photographs that they took, many of those were then kind of incorporated into kind of collages. So they were kind of fragmented and shown within a kind of broader body of work that was collage. So the context they were living in almost kind of prevent them showing a lot of their portraiture. And that was to do with the rise of fascism in Europe. Claude Cahun was Jewish, and so they decided with the rise of fascism and kind of a lot of anti-Semitism at the time, following the Dreyfus affair as well, yeah, they both kind of wanted to move to live a more rural lifestyle anyway. And in 1937, they moved to the Channel Island of Jersey. And yeah, they kind of described it as a holiday with no end, you know, that was just, you know, they holidayed there as children and as teenagers. And so it kind of represented this kind of secluded but idyllic kind of lifestyle for them. Mm. And then in 1940, the German military forces occupied Jersey. So that completely changed their lifestyle and the lifestyle of all the residents there, where they, yeah, they were prevented from like listening to the radio, and a lot of houses were requisitioned for German soldiers. And, you know, key to Claude and Marcel's kind of artistic work was also their resistance activities. So that's something that was intertwined with their creative output. So they were completely courageous in the way that they never, you know, they always, yeah, challenged the kind of occupation of Jersey, challenged this kind of horrific kind of political ideology that was kind of sweeping Europe. And they produced lots of resistance kind of notes and leaflets and propaganda that they distributed around the island, and particularly kind of encouraging soldiers to stand down and, you know, not follow Hitler's orders. And actually the two of them, they orchestrated this amazing resistance campaign for about 4 years until they were found out and arrested. And Claude actually described those activities as kind of connecting with their kind of surrealist activities as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's really interesting how their kind of activism penetrated both their kind of, you know, you see the portraiture, which is so radical for its time, particularly in the way that they're using costume and they're staging it with props and kind of makeup and really playing with that idea of a fixed gender identity, you know, and this is the early 20s. So they were incredibly brave in the way that they portrayed themselves and kind of probed those stereotypes. And so I think that kind of that sense of kind of courage and activism kind of filtered through so much of their practice, you know.
Which, yeah, kind of ultimately censored them at the time.
It did. Yeah. It did. And so when they were arrested, the Gestapo raided their home and found their photographs and found a lot of their kind of resistance notes and their photography and artwork. And so a lot of it was kind of destroyed.
Mm.
So what they have now in Jersey Heritage Collections is, you know, their remaining work. But yeah, they deem their portraits, yeah, they weren't acceptable. They kind of completely frowned upon them. Mm. And, you know, because I suppose because they were kind of, you know, some of them, you know, Claude would be kind of half dressed, or kind of, you know, they would show nudity, or they would be challenging stereotypes. And yeah, I think for these kind of very kind of fascist conservative viewpoints, they found their imagery degrading, you know. And so yeah, that prevented them very much from showing it.
I guess it's interesting because, you know, nowadays their work is studied in art history and certainly recognized for its value and its importance. Can you tell me a bit about, I guess, that shift to recognizing their work and ending that censorship?
Yeah, I mean, Claude died when they were 60, and Marcel lived longer and sadly took their own life when they're in their 70s. So yeah, I mean, when they both passed away, I mean, very much because their work really hadn't been exhibited and shown widely, it did kind of fall into obscurity. And you do get this, I think, with quite a few artists from around that time. And it takes like an art historian or someone like that, you know, to rediscover their work and also really place it within a lineage of kind of artists as well. And I think sometimes that's the, you know, whilst they were associated with the surrealist movement, they weren't kind of really in their inner circle. So these kind of genres that we think of, you know, it's great to think of like the Surrealist movement, but actually a kind of, you know, there were so many artists working that were on the periphery as well, you know. So yeah, that rediscovery in the 90s kind of paralleled a kind of, I suppose, a feminist kind of researching and kind of rediscovery of many artists that I suppose were really kind of challenging gender stereotypes and kind of, you know, the way that they were thinking about identities as, you know, plural and kind of performative rather than fixed, kind of paralleled the kind of identity politics at the time as well, kind of in the 90s. So through that kind of intersectional lens, their kind of work was kind of rediscovered and kind of held up as like this beacon of, you know, how incredible is this work, you know, this has been made in the 20s and 30s, you know. So it kind of makes sense that their work was rediscovered at that point. But also, you know, I think it's important not to just read it through a contemporary lens as well and to understand the context that they were making it in. And very much, you know, they were so unique and individual in the way they approached portraiture, the kind of braveness that they were so bold and incredibly clever in the way that they staged themselves through portraiture. So yeah, you've got that rediscovery, but I think it's important to kind of think about, you know, they were a huge influence on like Cindy Sherman and people like that. Probably Cindy Sherman wouldn't exist if it wasn't for, you know, looking at some of those photographs by Cahoon and Moore, you know. But yeah, I think they're just the most incredible artists, you know, their lives and the work they produce, that it's hard not to be completely just in love with them, really.
You know? I wanted to point out as well, with this exhibition, you've made the conscious decision to recognise both artists as co-authors of their work, even though historically these photographs were credited as Cahoon's self-portraits. Can you talk to me a bit about that choice in presenting their work as a duo?
So yeah, I feel like this has been a bit of a, you know, there's been various debates. And I think when you're looking back, you know, at history and, you know, no one was there, so they didn't didn't see how these kind of portraits really kind of took place. But it's obvious through the staging and the way that have been kind of realized that, you know, Cahoon could not have been the subject and the person taking the photograph as well. And, you know, it's evidence in various bits of writing as well by Cahoon that, you know, their process was a collaborative one. You know, and I think the majority of art historians now would recognise them as co-authors. I think, you know, you always fall into that trap of, yeah, I suppose that kind of, sometimes when you don't recognise a kind of collaboration, sometimes it's about you're kind of holding up this kind of singular artist to be this kind of artistic genius or something, like it's more valuable, which I don't agree with at all. Because, yeah, everything they did, it was a collaboration. Is it a collaboration of the minds? It was, you know, they absolutely did kind of everything creatively together, you know. Whereas Cahoon is often the subject in the photographs, that doesn't mean that Marcel wasn't involved. You know, they would have been likely very involved in the concept, the staging, the costuming, the props. So it's a collaboration that kind of goes through all the different mediums they worked in, from writing to collage to performance to photography to their resistance activities.
I want to come back a little to something you were talking about a bit before. The rediscovery of Cahoon and Marcel's work paralleled the rise of postmodern feminism as part of this expansion of understanding identity politics, as you say, acknowledging gender as performative rather than fixed and refusing as essentialist feminism. In this vein, their work and identities were very situated in their own genderqueer identities. Are you able to speak a little to this, I guess, slippage of identity and their artistic style that is both a part of and seen within their work?
Yeah. I mean, Cahoon famously said, you know, masculine, feminine, neuter is the only kind of term that kind of suits me. So they were very open in the way that they disregarded kind of binary categories and kind of didn't see themselves as fitting within that. I think it's very clear when you see some of the portraits that they are performing, and they're performing almost as lots of different characters, that they, you know, they all kind of connect and they are of one person, but really they are kind of playing out those roles. So that's something that Colquhoun did consciously. And yeah, I mean, we've got some really early portraits of Colquhoun kind of pre-1920, and they would walk around kind of, you know, Parisian cafes with a shaved head, wearing a men's suit, you know, sometimes with like short hair that they would dye pink, you know. So they were very bold in the way that they expressed themselves through their kind of clothing and their appearance, and that very much comes through the portrait. But yeah, there's an amazing kind of very early portrait where it's a close-up of them and they're kind of looking directly at the camera on their bed, and their hair is kind of splayed out and they're kind of meant to kind of reference Medusa. Then there's a later one which is actually our kind of lead image for the show, where they appear as this kind of boxer, but they're very much in this kind of overtly kind of feminine kind of costuming, and they've got kind of they've got hearts painted on their cheeks, and yeah, and a kind of slogan that's like, says, "I'm in training, don't kiss me," you know. So it's this, there's a real playfulness through that comes through the portraits. There's another one which is very kind of Cindy Sherman-esque. So Colquhoun wore lots of masks as well in their work, and it was that kind of very, yeah, clear way of kind of, you know, changing up and wearing a different mask for a different persona, you know. So there's one where they appear almost very doll-like with this very this mask that covers their face, and then they've got attached to their cloak these like Venetian Colombina masks, so kind of Venetian ball type masks. And the kind of the multiplicity of all of those masks is quite interesting, thinking about, you know, you're donning a different mask every time you feel like kind of being a different kind of person or a personality. So yeah, there's lots of, I'd say that there's a real kind of sense of performance and kind of playfulness with the way they present themselves. And yeah, really thinking about kind of identity as something that is malleable and always changing.
And yeah, I think, like what you said before, trying not to apply a contemporary lens to them, you think about the context in which they're, you know, creating work like that and having those identities is quite amazing. And I think it's just such an important reminder that queer people have always existed and have always been there, no matter the context in which they're living in.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that is a key point behind doing the show as well, that it's important for rainbow communities to see themselves reflected in the past as much as the present. And, you know, looking back, you know, 100 years, you know, you're seeing this work, and you're learning about these incredible individuals who were living life as they saw fit, you know, despite living in a very dangerous and divided society. You know, they were completely committed to absolutely being themselves, you know. And I think that's an important message that we kind of need to remember now.
It's so powerful. It makes you feel quite emotional.
Like, it does.
Even
it does.
Seeing the show, it's just like,
yeah, gosh. It does. I know. I got tingles when I like saw some of the portraits on the wall, because also I feel like, you know, I studied these artists in art history, like, you know, moons ago, but I never thought I'd, you know, be able to put a show of their work on, you know. And it's just, yeah, it's been so great being able to kind of, yeah, think about how we're going to present it, and, you know, being able to be flexible with the scale of the images as well has been amazing. And yeah, just seeing details in some of these works that you've never seen before, you know, because you're just looking online or in a book, you know. So yeah, I think hopefully people will really connect to it and get a lot from it.
Yeah, totally. I guess you kind of touched on it there, but I'm going to ask you anyway, just because I think it's important. This is, as you say, the first time Kahuna More have been exhibited in Aotearoa, which I think has its own significance in and of itself. But I think it's a really interesting and important time within our political climate to be exhibiting them. The exhibition, of course, aligns with the 40th anniversary of the Homosexual Law Reform Act of 1986 in Aotearoa, all while we're seeing our government propose the legislation definitions of woman and man amendment bill, which would effectively write genderqueer, trans, takatāpui and non-binary New Zealanders out of the law. I guess for you, what do you think the significance is of bringing Kahuna More to Aotearoa audiences?
Yeah, I think it feels incredibly timely. And yeah, I think what's happening in regards to, you know, the government at the moment here is just really shocking and disappointing and just another way of just bullying, you know, people. And I think looking back at, you know, Kahuna More's work, you just, yeah, there's so incredibly powerful people who, yeah, who went against a lot of social norms at the time. I mean, this was 100 years ago. I kind of think it's a, you know, I can't find the right word, but I think I can't believe that we're still debating this 100 years on, you know, and we're, you know, somehow seeing certain people as a threat to other people. And it's just completely wrong. So, yeah, I think in a positive way, I hope that people find this exhibition affirming. I hope they feel a sense of connection. We're going to be doing lots of great events with the public program. We've got a special event with the Charlotte Museum where we're going to be going and visiting the Charlotte Museum and seeing some of their archive related to the kind of homosexual law reform. So that's going to be really exciting. We've got a variety of talks and workshops. We've got film screenings. So I think hopefully, you know, the exhibition will, yeah, generate timely and important conversations. Hopefully, you know, I just think at the time, like, Kahuna More was so, they always believed in the ability to change people's minds. They never, even when, you know, they were doing these resistance activities and, you know, all this, you know, horrendous stuff was happening in Jersey with the occupation, they never really blamed the German troops or the German soldiers. They always believed that individually they could change, people can change their minds. And I think that is such a important thing to remember, you know, that, you know, even if you might not agree with someone's viewpoints, you know, it is possible for people to kind of reassess and really think about, you know, what's happening and to change their minds for the better. So, and I think that relates to a lot of things happening at the moment. So, yeah, hopefully the exhibition will, I don't know, be a little prompt in the right direction.
Yeah, I hope so. That was curator of Gus Fisher Gallery, Lisa Beauchamp, speaking to me about Studies for a Keepsake, the first exhibition in Aotearoa to be showing pioneering French artists Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore. As Lisa mentioned, there is a really excellent public program running alongside the show. Tomorrow, Lisa and co-curator Ruth Minha will be hosting a co-curator tour of the exhibition from 2 till 3 p.m., so definitely go check that out. And then there's lots of other events to check out over the coming months, which you can find more information on their website. The exhibition is on at Gus Fisher until the 22nd of August, so be sure to head on over.